Just Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibilities.
Well, hello, and welcome to Just Energy Radio. Maybe I should play the music over again. You know, that mute button, it gets me every time. So, it does. And so let me do my intro again. God, I feel like such a space case. Before I bring Gary on and we start the show, I would just want to thank everyone for your years of support. So please enjoy every minute of the time you spend with your families and friends this holiday season. Remember to hug your loved ones and tell them that you love them. And I wish you a very happy and joyous holiday season, and I pray your new year is filled with love. And, I had all kinds of hands in there, too. And so let me tell you, okay, so today's show, you know, Gary, every time I do these great intros, my mic is always muted, and it's just really embarrassing. So today's show, we have Gary Tillery on, and we're going to be talking about John Lennon, and December 8th marked the anniversary of his passing, or transition, and I thought it would be great to commemorate him and his work, because his work has really transcended generations. My parents love John Lennon. We love John Lennon. My kids love John Lennon and his work. In the second hour, we're going to be talking to Jerry Pippin about Roswell and beyond. And I'm very, very good friends with Jerry, and you just never know what we're going to be talking about during that period of time. So let me tell you a little bit about Gary, and we're going to start talking about John Lennon. Gary Tillery spent 2 decades in the business world before turning his time and energy to his lifelong passion for literature and art. His fascination with the intellectual beetle led him to write The Cynical Idealist, a spiritual biography of John Lennon. He has also published Darkling Plain, a collection of short stories set in Vietnam, and 2 humorous detective novels, Death Be Not Loud and An Atheist Dying Young. Tillery is also a professional sculptor. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio, Gary Tillery. Hi, Gary. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Rita. Very, very nice. Thank you.
I'm not laughing at you. I'm just laughing at myself.
That was pretty good. This end, I don't
Well, you know, other than that, you know, 5 minutes of just dead silence while I'm, you know, looking other places, my notes over here, reading your bio, which is on a different screen, till I go to click your mic, and I realize we're both muted. So, yeah, it's a good day in the neighborhood. Anyway, so Gary, how did you... It's not the first time. It's just one of those days. How did you become interested in John Lennon, and what led you to write this biography about him?
I kind of stumbled into it. I was involved in a sculpting project, which actually never got off the ground, but it got me to do some research on him. This would have been around the year 2000, I guess. And it was one of those things. The more I listened to his lyrics and the more interviews I read, the more impressed I became. I mean, I thought Lennon was an intriguing and imposing figure before, but when I really got into it, it's like the more you study this guy, the more you realize how impressive he was. He's mind-blowing, actually. So I started sketching out ideas, and that led into a book, which took me a few years to write and has been through a few incarnations. But that's how it all came about.
Well, that's great. You know, most people remember John Lennon as one of the Beatles, who obviously was a superstar that almost eclipsed God. I mean, his popularity, you know, as you even say in your book, was and is up there with Jesus, not meaning to be, you know, derogatory in any way. But who was John Lennon the man? I don't think people really have been or are able to see beyond his fame.
Well, I'll explain it. I didn't say in the book that he was up there with Jesus. He was up there with Gandhi and Martin Luther King, or almost in their class in terms of what he stood for and the number of people that he reached. And, you know, the thing in the mid-60s, what he said was, we're more popular than Jesus, not better than Jesus. He was kind of reflecting on Beatlemania at that time, which, you know, it's hard to imagine now what it was like then. I mean, unless you're old enough to remember it, it was incredible. I've never seen a period like that. But as far as Lennon the man, he was human. He had a big desire to succeed in this field, and when he got to the top, which was, you know, 63, 64, the top of his field, he found out that something was missing. I mean, all of this, you know, after you've struggled and done everything you can and put out a, you know, 150% effort, then you get there and you find out that it's empty. It left him with a spiritual crisis, which occurred in 65. And it took him like a decade to work his way through that and come up with his own view of the world. But through it all, I mean, he was just a guy, you know, who was very intelligent and talented in songwriting, but he was just a person faced with all these things and trying to solve, you know, the situation for himself.
But didn't he come from, you know, a very humble beginning? He wasn't born with a silver spoon that allowed him to start off life privileged and, you know, help. I mean, because I think, you know, people that have money, it's easier to make money and get the promotion and get that kind of backing. But he came from very humble beginnings, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Not actually as much as the other three, but he ended up living with his aunt and uncle when he was starting from about the age of five, and his uncle owned a dairy farm. So it wasn't like they were hard scrabble, but nevertheless, it was kind of a working class life that he'd been born into, or grown up in, I should say, not born into. And he didn't get money and fame until, you know, the Beatles, which was probably age 20, 21, 22, something like that.
But wasn't his life also, I mean, he grew up with his aunt, so where were his parents during all of this time?
Well, he never really knew his father. His father was a steward on a ocean liners, and then during World War II kind of did a similar type job for the merchant marine in Britain. And he traveled, and I think for the first 5 years of Lennon's life, his dad was there for like 2 or 3 months. I mean, it was minimal. And his mother didn't bear up very well under this. She ended up seeing other men and fell in love with a couple of other guys and ended up having children from these other husbands or other men. So eventually the aunt, her older sister, Mimi, Aunt Mimi, suggested that John live with her, and finally the mother agreed, Julia, who was his mother, agreed, and he lived with Mimi from, I think, the age of five until he grew up, really.
You know, from a psychological point of view, you know, in contemporary times, there's, you know, a lot of commentary about, you know, the impact of not being brought up by your parents or having that separation, you know, that back in those days, there really wasn't a lot of talk about it. But in today, you know, today's days and age and today's psychology, you know, I could see where not having his, you know, biological parents around, you know, and the abandonment around that would really, you know, play a heavy role in his personal development later on in life.
It was very traumatic. I mean, if you listen to his song Mother, for example, I mean, you can feel the pain. It's just a very searing type song. And he mentions in the song not only his mother but his father, that they'd both gone out of his life now. So, yeah, he had demons, if you will, for decades after that, which he didn't really get rid of until, if you ever do, but he didn't get the worst over with until he was like 30, and he went through primal scream therapy. So it took him a long time to work through that. And probably those demons were what fueled his desire, you know, to succeed in rock and roll and the musical world.
So what kind of impact did that have on him, you know, growing up or, you know, as an adult, you know, that upbringing?
Well, again, I think it fueled his desire to succeed. He didn't want to go up. He had no interest in the normal career paths. He was kind of a rebellious kid, and he didn't try in school, even though he was really intelligent. But he did enjoy art, and he did enjoy rock and roll and music in general. So it caused him to take chances and, you know, going to Hamburg on a lark at the age of, I guess it was 18 or 19, and continue to, you know, to rebel against the world, to be very proactive, actually, in his own path. So it fueled him psychologically.
Well, and I think for, you know, during those times, that was very, I'm going to say, rebellious or, you know, against the norm because, you know, in the 50s, you know, I think of that movie Pleasantville, you know, where everyone's got their little sweaters and, you know, everybody kind of does the same things because that's the norm. And it sounds like the life and lifestyle and his personality just really did not fit into the norms of the time.
Well, no, that's true. And in fact, you know, as a Beatle, as a group, they were instrumental in changing all that, you know. What we think of as the 50s with the old, you know, Leave It to Beaver and the Donna Reed Show mentality, they helped overthrow that in the 60s. They were willing to take chances, and they saw things differently, and they were free-spirited, and of course Lennon was the leader of the group.
So John was the leader and not Paul? I don't know, I always thought Paul was in charge. How did that happen?
Paul always thought that. No, I think even Paul acknowledged that John was the leader. He was a year older when the group started. He was the one who brought Paul into his group. And for the first several years of the Beatles' existence, most of the songwriting was done by John. I mean, they collaborated, but the driving force of most of that stuff was John. Wasn't until 66, 67 that it turned, and Paul kind of eclipsed him in terms of energy and turning out new material.
And so how did his music, I mean, there's, I mean, I think everybody, well, I mean, this might be a little far-reaching, on the planet is familiar with the Beatles. You know, maybe not, oh, that's a Beatles song, but the music of the Beatles, and in particular John Lennon's music. You know, how did his music impact the world?
Well, it impacted anyway because they somehow caught the drift of what was happening, and you know, with their style, their upbeat, infectious style. So they did that. I'm losing the thread here. What was your question again?
How did his music impact the world?
Well, he starting in like 65, started seeing an opportunity in what they were doing. It wasn't just songwriting anymore. He was beginning to see that they could influence things through their music and, you know, open minds and have a positive impact. And I think that's when it really took off for them. I mean, as a cultural force was during that period. And again, that goes back to his spiritual crisis that he had in late 65, about the time of Nowhere Man. We, you know, think of that as just a song, but actually that was very revealing about his own self-perception at that time. He was in crisis, I'm saying. Go ahead.
I think a lot of musicians, especially during that era, really were, you know, using music and using song to express themselves, express their viewpoint about either their lives or society in general, wouldn't you say?
I would, but I think it came from them. I think it came from the Beatles kind of opening the door. Well, to an extent, it was Bob Dylan. I've got to give him some credit here. I think he impressed Lennon because he showed him that just because it's pop music doesn't mean it's all, you know, love and loss. You can say and do more with it. But once Lennon caught on with that, you know, and their songs became much more influential, I think. All You Need Is Love is a good example. The world had reached a point with all these satellites, the communication satellites being put up, reached the point where it was possible to broadcast one program simultaneously around the world. And so everyone conceived the idea of doing a show and broadcasting it live at the same time. A number of countries participated. One of them, I mean, Britain was one of those. And what were they going to do with their time slot? Well, they asked the Beatles to do it because they were the most popular group on the planet. And Lennon and McCartney, in this sense, in this case, saw it as an opportunity to do something more. And instead of just knocking off three or four of their songs, popular songs, for self-promotion, they decided they would write a new song and record it live. And that's how All You Need Is Love happened. But actually, it was a Lennon song. He wrote that one by himself. And it pretty much summarized his philosophy, his thinking at that time. People didn't realize it necessarily. They thought it was just another Beatles song. But, you know, when you get lines in there like, learn how to be you in time, you know, what does that mean? You know, he was trying to get people to think and change their hearts. And he had an audience of like 400 million people for that show. So I think at that point he was beginning to see, you know, the possibility of being, I don't know if either Gandhi or Martin Luther King exactly fits, but being some kind of a force for making the world better. And that's, he started from that point.
Well, and I think, you know, that song, you know, transcends time. You know, you listen to you know, certain music and it's very period and whatever, and songs like that and some of their other songs, they're timeless. You know, that one in particular, it's applicable at any point in time.
But he was trying to, yes, they are. He was trying to plant a seed philosophically there, though. You know, there's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. You know, what happens when people want to go out and change the world? You know, they go out. What he's saying is go in. You know, change yourself, because it's the one thing that no one else can do. You know, and if you go out, you're likely to be frustrated, you know, and give up after a while. But if you're going in, you can change yourself, make yourself a better person, a more loving person, a tolerant person. And you can influence the people around you, you know. And if you can influence them, maybe they can influence other people, and it kind of spreads out like ripples. So it was a very philosophical song. And when he said, you know, learn how to be you in time, that's what he meant. You know, pick your direction, change yourself, and be the person you can be. You know, it was no longer, you know, love and loss type songs that he was shooting for at that point.
And I think that's really interesting because, you know, I'm going to say in the last 2 or 3 years in the metaphysical, new age, you know, whatever, spiritual community, there have been a lot of books that have come out that talk about being your authentic self, you know, getting to know who you are, speaking your truth, you know, from the inside, not just reiterating the status quo,
right. You
know, but speaking your truth. And it sounds like he was basically saying the same thing many, 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 many years ago that people are just starting to catch up on now.
Yep.
So let me ask this. He had been involved, and, you know, I was going to write down that guy's name, but with that Maharishi, whatever, Sexy Sadie. We'll just go with Sexy Sadie because that I remember.
Okay.
How influential was that, you know, experience on his life? I mean, was he involved with him for a long time, and are some of his philosophical beliefs based on the Maharishi's philosophies, or did he come about these understandings in a different way?
Well, it came about them in a different way, but the encountering the Maharishi is what it is. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is who it was. Lennon was already in this mode of trying to improve the world and seeing the opportunity to do it. And when he learned about the Maharishi, here was somebody who was trying to do the same thing, but he had a technique. He had a process already in place, which was the Transcendental Meditation. So when Lennon heard him, he thought, well, this is great. The guy's already got this in place. So he jumped on board. Now, they lasted, let's see, from August of, I think it was 67 until about May of 68. He and the other Beatles, in various levels of interest in the Maharishi, Lennon and Harrison in particular, really liked what was going on. But they went to his ashram in India and learned how to meditate from this guy, and they were meditating like 6-8 hours a day, and they were looking into or considering the Maharishi's worldview, which was that there are 7 different levels of consciousness and all that. And this, I don't know, Lennon may have really accepted this, or maybe he didn't, because he never really went anywhere with it. But the fact of the meditation is a process, a technique, which is helpful in changing the person. He always agreed with that and kept with that, you know, for the rest of his life. He was a meditator, you know, and he saw it as kind of a, not a religious thing, but a secular thing, that this is something that works, you know, and actually changes your brain. So in that sense, the Maharishi influenced him, but not for very long. And then he and Harrison had a falling out with the Maharishi. Apparently the rumor was that the Maharishi had been giving some of the female disciples more than enlightenment there. And so they broke up the and left abruptly. And he wrote this song about him and, you know, made a fool of everyone. And then before he actually recorded it, he changed the name to Sexy Sadie because he didn't want to deal with the legal problem.
In listening to the Beatles' history prior to reading your book and prior to talking to you, it just left me with the impression that there had been involvement between, you know, him, George Harrison, and the Beatles in general for a really extended period of time, not just several months.
Well, no, it just, remember, the during this period, the Beatles were incredibly popular. I mean, you couldn't pick up a paper or magazine without them being in it. So it probably looked like that, that they were, that it was a big, long-lasting thing. But actually, it was pretty short-lived.
Well, Gary, there's the music, which means we need to take a quick break. And so when we come back, let's talk about the title of your book, The Cynical Idealist, and what caused John to become cynical around the world. So I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Gary Tillery about his book, The Cynical Idealist, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
To energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today. How would you like to live long and enjoy great health? How about creating solid bones and whiter teeth, strengthen your heart and eyes, and have radiant, youthful-looking skin? There is an ancient health and longevity secret that has been used for millennia in Egypt, India, and China that can help you achieve this. For the first time in the modern world, Pearlseum brings ancient wellness secrets to you. For more information about Pearlseum, visit www.ancientpearl.com. Before we get back to the show, I want to thank all of you for tuning in to Just Energy Radio this evening. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit soulhealer.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for staying tuned to the show. We're here talking to Gary Tillery about his new book, The Cynical Idealist, A Spiritual Biography of John Lennon. So, Carrie, why do you say that John was a cynical idealist? What does that even mean?
Well, most people think of cynical as a person that's sour and pessimistic, and that's not the way the dictionary tells you. It's actually has to do with motives. A cynic is a person who thinks that people do things out of their own best interest, their own self-interest, let's put it that way. So if anybody should be a cynic, it was John. I mean, here he was, world famous, rich, incredibly popular. I mean, the people who came up to him, you know, everybody had an agenda. Everybody wanted something, and it would be pretty easy to see. So in that sense, I think of him as a cynic. And yet, in spite of that, he kept thinking that we could all get better. I mean, he kept envisioning a world that, you know, even though everybody is going to act in their own self-interest, we can still have a common vision and we can improve this place. And, you know, through imagining it to be a better place and acting that way. So in my mind, that's why I called him a cynical idealist. Now, it does tie in also, I see a connection between him and the old cynics from the time of Socrates. Especially there was one cynic called Diogenes. They even call him Diogenes the Cynic because he kind of dropped out of society back in ancient Greece. He'd had it with everybody's pretensions and the hypocrisy and, you know, everybody playing social games. And he lived in a big barrel at the edge of town. He would tell people exactly what he thought. You know, he didn't put any nicety on it at all. And he just said it, told it like it was, you know. And that strikes me as a John Lennon type thing. And Lennon reached a point where he didn't care what he said or who it hurt or helped. But he wanted to tell the truth. And it got him in trouble, and he didn't care. And he wanted to live his life the way he wanted to do it, you know, with Yoko as opposed to the former Beatles life. And he just did it, you know. So anyway, there's a connection with the old philosophers, so.
Well, and I get the impression that, I mean, I hate to say it this way, but when you view life that way, there's one, some trust issues in the general sense of the word, but it causes you to stop and try to look underneath the surface of what's being presented to you and dig and try to find the truth, whatever that is. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, as opposed to just accepting the status quo?
Well, I remember he had a song called Give Me Some Truth. That was his point, you know. He kept digging. He didn't want necessarily easy answers, you know. He questioned everything. So, yes.
And it just seems like, you know, coming from humble beginnings and then having more money than God, not that God has money, and then having that experience where people just want stuff from you all the time, and it doesn't have anything to do with you, the person. It has to do with you, the personality, you, the individual with money, would also add to that cynicism.
That's exactly right. He was pulled. They tried to pull him in all these different directions. After he went through his primal scream therapy, he released an album, and one of the songs was "I Found Out." And the lyrics start off, "I've told you before, stay away from my door. Don't call me that, brother, brother, brother." You know, it's like you can just see the people around him calling him brother, trying to, you know, wheedle something out of him or persuade him to do something, and, you know, he's just seen through it all. He doesn't want to play that game anymore.
Got old, huh? So let's talk a little bit about Tim and Yoko, you know, in the news, they only ever got bad press. So what was the deal with them? I mean, was she, like, as bad and evil as they tried to make her out to be? Or, you know, what was their relationship like? And how did that, you know, anything. Maybe you can spend some time clearing the air and maybe doing some healing around Yoko in general and what their relationship was like.
Well, I mean, I can tell you from my vantage point, obviously I wasn't there and I didn't know any of the personalities involved, but from my research and study of it, I think he himself said he was ready to leave. He was tired of being a Beatle. Even after the last tour in 66, he said he'd had enough. He felt like he was in a straitjacket. And he wanted to move on, but he didn't know how, and he didn't know what to do. And then she showed up. And she was an artist herself, had been one for years, long before the Beatles had started. And not started, but long before they got big. So when they got together, she kind of reinforced this side of him. See, he was an artist in high school, what we would call high school, and had thought of himself that way, and she kind of reignited that for him. And instead of saying, you know, oh, you're so great, you're so great, she said, what are you doing art-wise, you know, and, you know, think of life that way. And so all of a sudden it became okay for him. You know, this guy who had been married and had a child, who was about five or six, I think, living in the suburbs of London, you know, and a Beatle putting songs on the charts and all this kind of thing. She was saying, you know, be a free spirit again. What's the problem? You're an artist, you know. And he found that liberating, you know. It reinforced what he had been feeling. And it gave him a road out of being, you know, this cute, cuddly Beatle that everyone had, you know, but they were kind of like prepackaged in those days in the mid-60s. It gave him a road out. So I think, I don't see it as she was some kind of monster at all. I think she gave him the opportunity to be himself as opposed to what he was being forced to do.
And with her having, I will assume, a successful art career herself, she came into the relationship not wanting something from him, but came in actually, excuse me, more as an equal, which is a really different dynamic as opposed to a groupie.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. He said so himself. You know, he, of course, tried, because he'd been raised in that way and had been successful as a rock star and all this, and he tried to treat her the way he treated other women. And she wouldn't let him, and she had her own personality and her own ego, and it took him years, but he finally realized, you know, that he needed to treat her as an equal. In fact, he was one of the earliest people for women's rights and equality. You know, he wrote songs about it before anybody else did, and she did that for him. She gave him the opportunity to be a feminist, a male feminist.
Well, wasn't he a house husband for a while?
Yeah, after he had worked through all of his issues, gotten rid of his demons, and tried one last time to get back to the freedom of his youth, you know, and then he realized that he wasn't all that happy being that way, which was like 75, 4 and 5. After that, they got back together, and he moved in with her in the Dakota in New York and settled down, and about that time she got pregnant with Sean, and he decided that he'd had enough of, you know, being God, the rock God, and he wanted to be John Lennon. So he settled down in the house, and he didn't even want to deal with the business, but she seemed to have a knack for it. So she took, you know, those reins, I should say. And he decided to stay with Sean and help raise him through the early formative years. So he became a house husband. You know, and at the time, now, even there's maybe a slight taint to it, to you know, the guy's manhood, you know, Kevin Federline or whatever. But you're talking the mid-70s. No one did this. I mean, it was just people couldn't believe that John Lennon, the macho John Lennon, was doing this, you know. But, again, he didn't care. You know, he just didn't care. He was going to go his own way. So he became a house husband.
But I bet that opened his eyes to what housewives' lives were like.
Yeah, he was pretty emphatic about that. I don't have the quotes in front of me, but in terms of finally seeing what it was that women had to do every day and put up with, you know, he was amazed. And of course, he was helping with this stuff, but he had a staff, you know, and he realized that, you know, the normal housewife, the regular housewife, didn't have a cook to help out or a maid to come in, you know, this kind of thing. So
do the laundry.
Yeah.
Pick the underwear up off the floor, that kind of stuff.
Oh, it's starting to hit home now.
But I bet it was enlightening. So,
yeah,
cool.
It was. And, you know, and I think of that, too, in terms of his philosophy. You know, how many people, the old philosophers, ever considered the domestic side? You know, they would come up with these, you know, Sartre would come up with his, you know, his book on being and nothingness and talk about, you know, ontological problems. And he didn't talk about picking up the laundry, you know, and this kind of thing. And it struck me that Lennon was a much more full human being, you know.
Well, that's an interesting thought. And I think by working through a lot of his stuff, it gave him the opportunity to experience, you know, both sides of life. And that freedom, I mean, now they talk about being your authentic self and doing what, you know, brings passion to you in your life, and he had that opportunity. Especially, you know, what comes to mind to me is his dad wasn't around for him, and he gets to not cause his son to experience the same thing from him.
That's very true, and I mean, it was satisfying for that reason. Plus, I mean, he felt the guilt over his first son. I mean, he was not there for his first son. He was so busy being a Beatle, so that he had a chance to make up for it, you know, with Sean.
That's cool. John was also a huge advocate for peace. Could you talk a little about some of the things that he did? I mean, between his music and his bed-in, which I remember watching on TV. But what other kinds of things did he do to promote peace? You know, you've mentioned Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. Why do you put him in that same category?
Well, I do it with trepidation. I say he's almost in their category because they did lead movements and do great things. And he did a similar thing with music. He kind of put it in people's psyches, you know, about, I think of him embedding these philosophical points in his lyrics. I think of it as like a Trojan horse. I mean, he's singing a song. You're in the person who listens ends up singing the song, and they may not even understand what he's getting at, but eventually one day they wake up and say, oh, we all shine on like the moon and the stars and the sun. What do they mean by that? You know, and then the recognition comes later. So I think he, in that sense, he touched millions and millions and millions of people and generations. You know, they still, every war that comes along, they redo, it seems like they redo, Give Peace a Chance. You know, so in that sense, he's had a continuing impact as a force for peace. And, you know, like the Darfur situation with the millions of people starving over there, when they got ready to celebrities and the musical people tried to help, they decided to do a Lennon of John, I mean, an album of John Lennon covers, you know, take some of his songs and record them and give all the proceeds. But the whole thing started, as I said, he had this desire to use his fame and to influence things for the better, even back in the mid-60s. He got a letter from someone who had done a program for the BBC. I think his name was Peter Watkins. And the BBC wanted a show to put together to show people how awful nuclear war was and what people would actually think about it. And this guy put something together that was so scary that they wouldn't let him show it. It was so problematic. And so he was very upset, and he sent Lennon a letter and said, you know, or maybe Lennon and Yoko at that time, a letter that said, you know, this is what happened, and I don't have any way to do the access the media like you do. What are you going to do about it? You know, can you do something? And that's when he and Yoko came up with the idea for the bed in, that they would spend their honeymoon in Amsterdam promoting peace. But they didn't tell everybody that. They just said they were going to have their honeymoon, and the press was invited. And it's like, you know, they fell over themselves, people to show up with cameramen and reporters and all that, because, you know, like 6 months before, John and Yoko had done this album cover where they were totally nude. So they were considered capable of anything, you know. So all the reporters showed up, and instead they get a sales job on peace. And that's when it all started. And, you know, Lennon was very big about incorporating the concept of humor into movements. He didn't want to see people in the streets getting shot at. He wanted to confront the powers that be with humor and levity. And so that's what he did. And he did that all of 1969, I think, until he finally met with Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Elliot Trudeau, to talk about peace. And they were planning to do a giant concert or festival in Toronto. And,
did that ever happen?
It didn't happen. John and Yoko weren't organizers, and the people who were organizing it kept changing the view of what ought to happen and whether people ought to pay or not, and it finally just fell apart. He did other things, too. I mean, he returned his award, MBE award that he'd gotten in 64 or 5 for the Beatles, in 65. He returned it to the Queen and as a gesture, and he was coming down against the British support for Biafra, the Biafra War, and also the support of the Americans in Vietnam. So that got a lot of press. He did a number of things besides the veterans.
Well, he was a master. The two of them were masters of getting press.
Yeah, well, he didn't need to be a master when everybody's standing in your face with a camera. I mean, it was like he knew they were going to be there anyway. So all he had to do was take advantage of it and keep people amused.
Didn't think of it that way. You know, there's the rest of us that are running around going, hey, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. I guess he didn't have that problem.
No, he was.
Yeah.
They wouldn't leave him alone. Actually, and then another thing he did was the billboard campaign where he said, war is over if you want it. Do you remember that one?
I do remember that. That was very cool.
The whole point being, you know, if everybody decides that they don't really want to support this, what can the government do? I mean, the government can only do it with the tacit support of the people. So, anyway, he did it.
Well, they didn't have the support. I mean, considering all the protesting that was going on, it's like, okay, I don't think these people are supporting the war.
Yeah, it became pretty clear. Nixon finally had to deal with it.
What do you think he would say about what's going on in the world today? Any conjecture?
Well, it's purely conjecture. I mean,
I didn't think that you were like a medium or anything, talking to John out there.
Although
on this show, it could happen.
Oh, okay. All right. No, I wish I were that brilliant, but I think he'd be writing songs about it. He would be calling attention to certain things. He was big on calling attention to solutions and redirecting the energy from the problem to the solution. I was reading about a nuclear power plant, and people were out protesting this nuclear power plant, wherever it was, and he said, you know, all that is energy wasted. You know, what they ought to be doing, he says, because people, there has to be power. Everybody wants, you know, their light bulbs to run and their houses to work. They should be focusing on the solution, which is, you know, other energy sources. And so that was one thing he did. He would try to be confronting the powers that be with humor, but I don't know exactly how. I'm not John Lennon, but he would still be.
I just think it's interesting that we still have not come up with any alternative solutions in all of these years.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, we have about 4 minutes left. And before we wrap up, based on John's life and work, are there any guiding principles you think he would want us to live by?
Yeah, I drew these out of my study of him in his life and his own quest. So I'm not sure that he would formulate these same principles, but it strikes me that these are at the heart of what he was saying. First, you know, we owe it to ourselves to question the truths our culture passes on to us. You know, the things we inherit as kids and take for granted, and question them, and be cynical about the motives of experts and those in authority. It just strikes me each of us has that right, but we never exercise or seldom exercise it. You know that we should, if we want to be independent adults, we should take independent positions instead of just taking this stuff for granted. Another thing that I took out, he basically committed himself to his life, making his life a work of art, he and Yoko, when they started on the bed and the peace kick. And it strikes me that that's good advice for any of us. You know, we owe it to ourselves to live our lives as though creating works of art. You know, some of us have fewer resources, some of us have more. But to the extent that we can, you know, we ought to live with verve and, you know, do something that fills us with passion. You know, do something that we feel. It doesn't need to be what anyone else thinks is right. It needs to be what we think is right. How many of us want to end up, you know, in retirement looking back and you know, wishing we'd done something or, you know, regretting not doing something? Third, we owe it to ourselves and our posterity to aim at self-transformation. You know, being the best we can be, and I don't mean Army. It could be Army. Don't get me wrong, it could be Army. But, you know, trying to improve ourselves, you know, better human beings. And that's not just for us. There's a ripple influence, which I think Lennon would agree with. It affects the people around us, and maybe those people can affect other people, and we can all end up with the ideal world, what we want, you know, not the world we're dreading. Let's act on behalf of the world we want to see.
Any other ones?
No, not really.
I mean, that's okay. Not really.
So, I mean, I had three principles.
Okay.
How much time do we have left?
About a minute. And I'll just make one comment, and then I'm going to give it back to you. It just sounds like with those principles, we're really being called to take responsibility for ourselves, our happiness, and the world around us.
Okay.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So do you have any last comments? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that a lot of people think of him as an atheist. A lot of people assumed that he was because of some of the positions he took. But I had a quote here. Somebody asked him directly one time, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "Yes. I believe that God is like a powerhouse, like where you keep electricity, like a power station, and that he's a supreme power and that he's neither good nor bad, left, right, black, or white. He just is. And we tap into that source of power and make of it what we will, just as electricity can kill people in a chair or you can light the room with it." So that was his view of God. And to the extent that didn't jibe with other people's views, that's why they considered him an atheist.
Well, and it has definitely much more of a Eastern kind of flair, which people are a little more used to hearing, but back then, not.
Right.
And so if somebody wants to get a copy of your book, where can they get it?
Well, they can order it through Amazon. They can order it through Barnes & Noble. They can order it through any bookstore. The publisher is Quest Books. They can also order it from them.
Okay, and the name of the book is The Cynical Idealist, a spiritual biography of John Lennon. Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your insights and wisdom about John Lennon with my listeners.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And we will be back with Jerry Pippin of jerrypippin.com after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Go deep inside yourself and venture into the realm of the unconscious mind with my Meditating on the Kabbalah guided imagery audio CDs. Discover who you are and what you want in life. Meditating on the Kabbalah can help you to open, clear, and revitalize the energetic pathways of your subtle being. They will support you in your spiritual quest by helping you to access the profound insights and inner guidance you need as you work in alignment with your highest good. Let them help you to release negative thoughts and emotions and clear away any limitations that may be keeping you from experiencing your full potential. Walk down the path to health, healing, understanding, and enlightenment with Meditating on the Kabbalah. Order your copy today at www.soulhealer.com. That's right, that's www.soulhealer.com. Balance in all things is critical to maintaining health. In the hectic drive of today's world, many of us forget to take care of our most important asset, ourselves. At productsforthesoul.com, we want to support your effort to nurture yourself. We offer a wide variety of herbs, supplements, and high-quality, ready-to-eat, all-natural foods. We even have guilt-free chocolates. Best of all, our products are delivered straight to your door. It's time to start loving yourself. Visit productsforthesoul.com and start loving yourself today.
You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today.